Yeah, I know. I'm as nervous about all this as you are. So. Okay, so then we're switching gears and not talking about payment, but talking about how do you encourage coordination and how do you contain volume? And so how is the commission, in a selected way, thinking about this? Remember, in the traditional fee-for-service environment, you have basically everything working against you. The incentives are to generate volume. You have siloed providers, freedom of choice, any willing provider. It is going to be always sets of suboptimal solutions in which people are going to be both happy and sad with. And here's a list of some of them. I'm going to name only one, and I was actually happy to hear it mentioned in the first presentation. The commission found a lot of variation in readmission rates, both across the country and within any given market, recommended a penalty on excessive readmission rates. There's whole sets of issues that we should discuss on question on that. But the Congress has picked it up, and this is starting to be implemented, and we too think that it is starting to have an effect on readmission rates. But again, I just want to emphasize some of these are all relatively suboptimal solutions. That has driven to legislation in the health reform law that says, well, let's look at new, more organized fee-for-service models, like the notion of, say, bundling around an episode where you're pushing risk to the provider on the basis of an episode, or asking providers to organize and take risk on a population basis. And I'll just say a couple of things here, say an accountable care organization. I'll just say a couple of things here. There's no evidence and no clarity whether this is going to work. There's a certain logic here and hope, I would say, but not a lot of evidence at this point. And the commission's view on the accountable care organizations, we have made many recommendations, but just two I'll emphasize for you. A real concern of bringing the communication between the providers and the beneficiaries into sharper focus and incentives for the physicians or for the beneficiaries to be more participatory in the accountable care organization. In other words, give them some incentives. If things go well, what do they get out of it? And then the second thing we would say about this is we were very strong in pushing that it has to be true risk-based. Most ACOs are one-sided. You get a bonus, but you don't get a penalty. The commission was very adamant that it should be a two-sided risk, and CMS has come forward with the Pioneer ACOs, which are, in fact, two-sided risks. And we should talk about that. And then you have competition and capitation and the managed care plans. And arguably, these problems should solve themselves because now the risk for volume and the task to coordinate has gone to the private payer. But that situation in Medicare went awry because Medicare, moving from left to right and just focus on 2010, chose to set its benchmarks way above fee-for-service. Plans bid at approximately about fee-for-service and were paid 9% above fee-for-service, for example. So every time we enrolled a person in managed care, it cost money. In the health reform bill, there has been a schedule of bringing those benchmarks down, and you see some progress benchmarks down. The bids have actually improved quite a bit. This is some positive piece of news. And then finally, we're paying less than we used to, but we're still paying more than we would have paid if the beneficiary was in fee-for-service. Okay, we're heading into the home stretch here, and I'm keeping an eye on this young lady over here because she looks fairly formidable. And but I'm not scared. I'm just saying she's formidable, okay? I just want to be clear about that. Maybe I'm a little scared. Okay, so then I want to... let's see. Oh, I'm going to move to... Oh, right. Last set of comments are about the provider or about the beneficiary. So think about what I've been saying is the commission is kind of putting pressure on fee-for-service and constantly sort of looking at those payment systems, trying to move people to more organized systems, whether it's organized fee-for-service or managed care types of models. But then there's the beneficiary. And obviously the beneficiary can have an influence on what happens either through their choice of where they get their insurance or at the point of service. And so the commission made a recent recommendation, and there's been getting some play. We've actually been asked to testify on this a couple of times, and I'm focusing now on the last three bullets here, in which we've recommended several changes, but just for simplicity in this conversation, we have said that the traditional benefits should be reorganized to provide a catastrophic cap and a schedule of co-payments instead of co-insurance. And the idea of those two changes is to give the beneficiary peace of mind that there's catastrophic coverage and clear line of sight on what their out-of-pocket expenses are by knowing their co-payments instead of co-insurance. Thank God somebody nodded. So I'm hoping this is getting through. And so that would lower the need to get first dollar coverage through Medigap or employers. And so what the second part of the proposal, the unpopular part of the proposal, is to require an additional charge on the purchase of first dollar coverage insurance. And the idea is if people continue to do it, Medicare will get the revenue. If they choose to go to non-first dollar plans, then Medicare will realize reductions in utilization. Okay, now I'm very much at the end. I don't know how much time. I do? Okay, so I thought it was like way out of time. Let's back up and tell some. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought I was way out of time. I apologize. 2 minutes? All right, so I was born. Truly, we can cover this in 2 minutes, please. Okay, so anyway, let me just close up here and maybe just do this a little bit more clearly. So the commission made this recommendation and said the traditional benefits should be changed to give greater insurance value to the beneficiary and some peace of mind and some clarity on their out-of-pocket. And then in return, or also coupled with this notion of discouraging first dollar coverage. We think the research is very clear on here on first dollar coverage that it generates utilization among certain types of services. This raises some very difficult questions. How do you deal with poor, and do you have to adjust subsidy programs if you make those changes? And we can talk about those on question. And to be crystal clear, when you go to those first discouraging first dollar coverage, you're probably discouraging both necessary and unnecessary services, and that's one of the difficulties of going in this direction as well. Okay, so in closing, in a sense, what you could do is think about this as the the world that we're in. We're always constantly trying to keep fee-for-service functioning and putting pressure on it, moving people to more providers, to more organized systems. But I think another conversation, and this is the closing point, and I think it segues to what Stuart is going to talk about, is do we need to start talking about the signals that we send the beneficiary so that in their marketplace, which of these models, assuming quality, and again, we've assumed that throughout this entire conversation, the signal to the beneficiary about which of these is the most efficient plan, if you will, for them to be in. And this raises the questions of the kind of the supreme premium support models. And in our June report, which comes out in 2 weeks, there is a discussion of the issues around premium support. No recommendations, not adopting the concept, but discussing the design issues with it. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you. As Liz said, I'm working on innovation at Heritage, so I've come up with a real innovation to solve the very problems that that you've just heard from Rick and others. I figured out exactly how to deal with the long-term sustainability and solvency problem and the budget problem, how to do this while being very popular with all elderly Americans, and to do it without affecting in any way the quality of health that people get. Just joking. I mean, I just thought I'd just say. But my views actually in the last year have changed a lot on Medicare. I turned 65, also I'm a proud member of AARP, so there really is no problem at all to solve. You just have to keep your hands off my program, and we'll all be fine. My second role was to sort of talk a little bit about the. This is really a sort of a political science problem, because I think, you know, when we look at this, it's often said that a group of health economists and even actuaries can get together and say, we can actually figure out how to solve this, it's just that nobody will do it. And so I just want to sort of reflect some thoughts on this issue from the point of view of kind of how the political system maybe operates, and sort of, you know, what does that leave me and maybe some others to conclude about the most likely way of dealing with these issues without any certainty, of course. And I think, first of all, and you think about the solvency climate that we're in, I do think, just building on the last presentations that we had before the break, that there are pretty good reasons to believe that we should be skeptical about the idea of any general long-term trend in the healthcare costs somehow substantially easing this problem. I mean, for one thing, you would have to expect Congress to make really tough decisions in the future, such as the ones that Rick mentioned with regard to the SGR and so on. And I just want to tell you, those of you that are in the private sector, sometimes Congress does not take tough decisions. And so that would be a bit of a problem, even with the current projections that Rick laid out. I think also that, you know, there is a lively debate, as we had, on whether or not we're seeing any long-term trends. And I must admit, there's arguments on both sides, absolutely. But from a political point of view, I would just say to David Cutler, if you're right, and if we really are going to see some reductions in the long-term trend, please don't tell anybody. Because once you tell anybody, Congress sees this as, you know, the modern equivalent of the peace dividend. You know, the problem is essentially solved. So I can now not, I don't have to do hard things. Indeed, I can spend the money up front. So one of the conundrums from a political point of view is the very thought that you might actually have solved the long-term trend problem in healthcare actually makes it more politically difficult to solve the Medicare problem when it comes to public expenditure in the healthcare area. And I think even if you think that all of these two issues will kind of solve themselves in some way, then it surely makes sense to have some kind of insurance policy from a kind of political or policy point of view, so that if things don't go according to plan, you've got some way of kind of a backstop of ratcheting down. And that's why a lot of us over many years have kind of been drawn to the idea of some kind of clear default long-term budget for the publicly funded healthcare part of our system, particularly the Medicare program. Back in 2008, a number of us actually in this room, Joe Antos and Bob Reischauer, Gene Sterling and others, and myself, came together with a proposal for a long-term, a 30-year budget in the Medicare area to be a ratchet, a default that would take significant changes in Congress and actions in Congress to override in some way. And that was sort of from the idea that we really do need to have some kind of clear long-term budget in this area as being really one of the only tools that will give us a chance of getting sustainability and solvency in place. And there are several reasons for this. One is, of course, that the very decision-making of Congress in this area is quite different from its decision-making in areas like the homeless or education. Somebody raised some of these things earlier. We have the idea of mandatory spending in the Medicare area and in Medicaid and some other areas, as opposed to discretionary in some other areas. And as long as that stays into place, the default in Congress is always to avoid doing anything in this area that will cause political pain, because the programs will be constantly going along, trundling along like the Mississippi River, whatever you do, as opposed to these other areas, including defense, where you've actually got to make decisions. So one reason to going to a long-term budget was to really move away from that autopilot approach in Congress. But secondly, it's also important, I think, to recognize that when you think about what's going on in the health system and the innovations that are occurring, I don't think I've ever met anybody who innovates and tries to come up with cost-cutting in order to make less money and have less revenue and less profits. They just don't do that. They only do it because competitors make them do it and they can't sell their product. Or somebody says, this is the only amount of dough you've got, pal. You know, live within it. You know, if you're talking to somebody building a house for you or something like that, that's kind of what you do. So the idea that somehow, without some pressure down, the sort of innovations, which are really great, will lead to a general reduction in the costs, and particularly in Medicare, I think is fanciful, given the way that what we really know about the nature of of the situation. And I think that therefore, unless one thinks about